ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Well, today is a great day because it's a day that I get to play one of my favourite games, which is where I get Norman to say words and then tease him about his weird pronunciation.
No, it's you've got the weird pronunciation, not me.
Me and the entire nation of Australia say words the weird way, and you're the only person that says them the right way.
Yeah.
Okay, could you please give me the name of a common over-the-counter non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug?
Ibuprofen.
Ibuprofen. And what's the other over-the-counter painkiller that isn't that, that can cause liver damage if you don't take it responsibly?
Paracetamol.
Come on, you say it differently to that. I've heard you say.
Paracetamol.
You say paracetamol.
No, no.
Yes, you do.
No. That's what Australians say.
No,
paracetamol, Jimmy.
All right. Good, fine. You're one of us now.
Good.
The other word that I find fun to say is the name for paracetamol that they have in the United States, which is acetaminophen. Acetaminophen.
Yeah, much more straightforward.
Yeah, I think so too. And what's the one that's derived from willow bark?
Aspirin.
Oh, yeah, that's the same. Okay, cool. On with the show.
And the show is What's That Rash?, where we answer your questions.
I am health reporter Tegan Taylor, and I am on Jagger and Turrbal land.
And I'm Norman Swan, physician and journalist on Gadigal land.
So we are talking today about over-the-counter painkillers. It's one of those ones that we've had quite a few questions from various people about. Deb is asking, which is better, aspirin or ibuprofen? Are they comparable? And we've also got a question from Bridget, which I think we can also answer in this episode.
Hi, my name's Bridget and I'm 8 years old and I have a question for you. How does Panadol get from your mouth to wherever it needs to go in your body?
Great question there from Bridget.
That's a great question. It's actually one that I've wondered about quite a lot because I remember there were ads on the TV a few years ago, Norman, that were since pulled because the ACCC found that they were misleading, where you sort of had a body radiating pain and the body was kind of clutching, say, its lower back. And then they took the painkiller and you could see it traveling to that very spot in the body and then like killing the pain. And I'm like, yeah, that's what I want. My back's sore. I want that thing to go straight there. But of course it doesn't. So how does it know where to go?
Well, that's a great question from Bridget. Paracetamol, acetaminophen, does not work by going to the part of your body that's sore. Your body gets bathed in this paracetamol when you take it and you absorb it from your stomach or your small bowel, but it actually goes to your brain. And paracetamol works on pain relief, and it doesn't work on all pain relief, by the way, by affecting how your brain works.
I am interested in knowing a bit more about that because my understanding is that we have a pretty good idea of how non-steroidal anti-inflammatories work, and we will talk about them in a sec. But my understanding is that we actually don't really have a great handle on how paracetamol actually works. It works, but we don't know how.
No, we don't. It was first synthesized in 1878, and it's actually a metabolite of a drug called phenacetin.
What do you mean? So that's something that your body breaks it down into?
Yeah, if you took this painkiller called phenacetin, one of the things it gets broken down into is paracetamol.
Phenacetin was an ingredient in Bex, if I'm not mistaken.
So this is one of the things that Australia was once notorious for. You know, what people used to say to each other when they weren't feeling that well was, why don't you just have a Bex and a lie down? And Bex contained phenacetin. And we essentially had an epidemic of Bex use containing phenacetin.
So it was aspirin, phenacetin and caffeine in a tablet or a powder, and people were like, yeah, cool, this I feel so much better and I don't know why.
And they'd get the powder in a little packet and they'd throw it down and swill it down with their beer, their whiskey, coffee or tea and purportedly feel better. And what it caused was kidney damage and kidney failure. And the revelation about phenacetin being so toxic was really promoted by the research of a South African-Australian kidney specialist, Professor Priscilla Kincaid-Smith. And phenacetin was removed from painkillers in Australia and around the world, and the epidemic of kidney failure went away.
So you're saying if you took phenacetin, your body would break it down, and one of the compounds it would break it down into is paracetamol. So when we found out that phenacetin was bad, we just kind of skipped the middleman and went straight to paracetamol?
Kind of. I'm not sure that how aware they were that it was a breakdown product of phenacetin. Paracetamol in huge doses is toxic to both the liver, very toxic to the liver, and can be toxic to the kidneys as well. So it's not free of kidney toxicity, but it's nothing like phenacetin. It's essentially a very safe drug if taken in the right doses. But the question is, why does it relieve pain? Why does it reduce fever? Because that's not the only thing that painkillers do, is that they reduce fever as well. And that's probably how it's been used in Bridget, from the sound of Bridget's voice. And they've looked at brain function here, and it may be involved in the endocannabinoid system. But it's, as you said right at the beginning, it's not fully understood. But what is understood is that its effects on pain are not where you feel the pain, they're in the brain.
Is it bad that we don't know how it works?
I once did an interview with somebody who had found that a certain drug worked in a condition, and I asked him what was the mechanism, and he said, haven't a clue, doesn't matter, it works and it's safe. A lot of the time when they don't know what the mechanism, they come up with a theory as to the mechanism, but really that's to satisfy people like us journalists rather than, they don't care. If it works, it works and it's safe, what the heck?
All right, well, let's talk about non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, because we do have a better idea of how they work. And of course, we have had this question from Deb asking which is better, aspirin or ibuprofen?
Well, it depends what you're using it for. Aspirin is much better for non-pain relief, in other words, antiplatelet activity to prevent you getting cardiac problems if you've already had a cardiac problem or a stroke. And ibuprofen is probably the ibuprofen family of drugs are probably better at reducing inflammation than aspirin, because aspirin is probably going to be used at higher levels than ibuprofen. For children, you must not use aspirin. Aspirin is not safe in children unless you're under strict medical supervision. And the reason is that rarely a child on aspirin can get a dreadful condition called Reye's syndrome, R-E-Y-E apostrophe S syndrome, which is a terribly damaging, life-threatening syndrome. So aspirin should not be used in children. It was rare, but not so rare that you wouldn't use it. So most people drift towards ibuprofen.
How does it actually work?
It works by inhibiting enzymes involved in inflammation. They're called COX-1 and COX-2, and they're inhibitors of these enzymes which are involved in the pathway to inflammation. But that's not the only thing that they're involved with. So, for example, the system is also involved in protecting the stomach against stomach acid. When you take non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, you can reduce the protection in your stomach, not through physical irritation, but because you've got the drug in your body, and they can produce stomach ulcers and sometimes catastrophic gastric bleeding. They can also increase the risk of high blood pressure, increase the risk of kidney damage. This is the ibuprofen family of drugs. So about 6% of people who are taking non-steroidals can have an adverse drug reaction.
That's quite large when you consider how available they are.
That's right. So the risk is relatively low, but you've got large numbers. And the older you are, the more risk you are. So doctors have got to be very careful about prescribing non-steroidals, although you can get them over the counter. If you've got a history of kidney problems, high blood pressure, and you're getting older and frailer, not necessarily good drugs to take. The reason that ibuprofen and another one called diclofenac are on the pharmacy shelves is that they're fairly short-acting, so they don't last in your body a long time.
What's diclofenac?
The common trade name is Voltaren.
It is interesting with things that you can get easily. You sort of think of them as being benign, but they obviously do work to reduce pain. And so it's obviously having some sort of activity happening in the body, which means there could be other activities happening in the body as well.
Yes, they do work, but you've got to be careful. They're not meant for high doses for long periods of time. And that goes for paracetamol as well. If you've got a lot of pain that's going on forever, you really do need to get checked up for it. But they don't work on everything. So, for example, on the health report, we have in the past referred to Australian research which looks at the effect of paracetamol on back pain, and it doesn't help back pain. The other non-steroidals, the ibuprofen family of drugs, ibuprofen, diclofenac, do have some effect on back pain, but it's not dramatic. Paracetamol is probably better than non-steroidals for tooth pain, And then you yourself might find that you've got a preference. I get migraine, but I'm lucky that paracetamol helps me. So you just got to, these painkillers don't work for every condition, particularly paracetamol, which works on the brain and not on the inflammation itself.
One of the things that you often see in advertisements for these sorts of drugs and on the packets is that you shouldn't take them for longer than a few days at a time. And then they always say, if pain persists, see your doctor. Is that because you shouldn't be taking them for a prolonged period? Or is that for them to sort of be like, if you're having pain for more than 3 days, maybe it's more than just a headache or acute back pain?
It's both. If you've got symptoms that you haven't had before and they're going on for an extended period of time, you need to get it sorted out and find out what's going on. But also, you don't want to be taking these drugs, particularly the non-steroidals, in reasonable doses for extended periods of time, because the longer you take it, the higher the dose, the higher your risk of side effects. And the one side effect I think that I've underplayed is gastric bleeding. It's that you can get disastrous gastric bleeding from a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. So you just got to be careful about these things and use them sensibly. Ibuprofen is safe in children. It's safe in most adults. I mean, we're not saying that this is a highly dangerous drug, but in a small proportion of people, particularly the elderly, particularly those with other problems, you just got to be careful or not use them at all.
We're really kind of articulating the potential harms of these otherwise pretty safe drugs today. Can we put it into context? Like if I've got a headache or I've sprained my ankle or I don't know, I'm trying to think of, you know, something that's small that's probably a couple of days. I know where the source of the pain is. I just need to hit it. What is the best combo?
Interestingly, there is some evidence that for pain relief, the combination of paracetamol with a non-steroidal, another non-steroidal like ibuprofen, can be as effective as an opioid analgesic. So if you feel that you haven't had great results from paracetamol, you can actually buy combinations of paracetamol and ibuprofen or other non-steroidals, which the evidence suggests you do get a reason. Still not great for back pain, but for other forms of pain, they may actually be at least as effective as the combinations that used to be freely available of, say, paracetamol with codeine or ibuprofen with codeine. That the combination of paracetamol and ibuprofen, remember, paracetamol works on the brain, ibuprofen works on the inflammation, may actually not be a bad combination without any extra harm. They don't interact with each other, so you're not getting extra harm.
In my N equals one trials, I find caffeine also very effective.
Which we've spoken about before. Caffeine is really a really important add-on and seems to enhance the effects of other painkillers, yes.
When we talked about caffeine, you implied that there's a situation where using painkillers can actually cause pain.
That's particularly in headaches. It's called analgesic-induced headaches, but it can happen in other chronic pain as well. You've got pain, you use painkillers and you keep on using them. They're not great at controlling the pain and you take more and more and more of them. For some reason, which is not fully understood, the painkillers themselves can be causing the pain or making it worse. So the treatment, which is very hard to do with people who are psychologically hooked on these and feel that they're relieving the pain, is actually to stop the analgesics. But this is something that really needs to be done with your GP and done carefully and slowly because it can induce quite a lot of anxiety. But stopping the painkillers can actually relieve your pain.
So a quick recap for Deb, which is better, aspirin or ibuprofen?
It depends. I refuse to commit myself. For general pain, it's ibuprofen or paracetamol. Aspirin should be reserved for the prevention of coronary heart disease and some specific conditions where aspirin is pretty good. But for general pain relief, stick to the ibuprofen family of drugs, those non-steroidals.
And a recap for Bridget, the Panadol goes into your brain and that's how it controls the pain in the rest of your body. Did I understand that right?
That's right. So it doesn't go to your sore hip or your sore arm. It goes to your brain and affects your pain perception. And remember, somebody might say, oh, well, is that worse for you than going for an anti-inflammatory? Just remember, the anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen don't change the disease. So if you're taking a painkiller for arthritis, ibuprofen is not going to make your arthritis better, even though it's an anti-inflammatory. It just allows you to get around more and to exercise more. So if you get the pain relief from paracetamol, you're not cheating yourself out of something by not using a non-steroidal. They do not change the course of the osteoarthritis. If only they did.
Mm, Indeed. So, Norman, we actually got an email. So last week we were talking about restless legs, and we got an email about that that also kind of references what we're talking about this week. It comes from Margaret, who said she loved our podcast on restless legs, and she sent us some leg emojis. And then she says she's been plagued by restless legs for many years. Her symptoms seem to be cyclical, but she can't really identify any reasons or triggers for it.
So what she says is, in fact, I've tried many things, but the most helpful is to get up, do a few stretching exercises and take paracetamol. My GP knows and is happy for me to do this. And interesting, she says she doesn't. Paracetamol doesn't work as a preventive measure, but it does seem to work when she actually has her restless legs. And her reason for Marg writing is to spread the word about what helps for her, which
so
is very nice of her.
Stretching exercises and paracetamol at the time of the restlessness rather than ahead of time.
That's right.
Any kind of mechanism by which that might work?
So stretching the legs, getting up and moving, is well known to interrupt the restless legs problem. So the question for Marg was, has she tried taking a Smartie or an M&M at the same time to see whether or not it's just the stretching the legs or the paracetamol adds to it? But paracetamol is pretty harmless. So as you've just discovered in this What's That Rash? So if you want to try it, have a go.
So you want her to do a placebo-controlled trial, but it can't be double blind because I think she'd be able to tell the difference between a Smartie.
That's right. And we're not in the business of providing placebos, but M&Ms are more fun.
Oh, thank you, Mark, so much for sending that in. And of course, if you have any questions or anything that you'd like to tell us, anything at all, you can email us with thatrash@abc.net.au.
We'll see you next time.
See you then.